Okay, here's a little slow blues called Just a Feeling, an old little Walter tune. Just a feeling, feeling I had on my mind. Just a feeling, feeling I had on my mind. Lay down dreaming, woke up this morning screaming and crying.
Oh man, I could listen to that all day long. That's my music right there. I absolutely love blues music. I hope you do too. This is Nate, here with another episode of The Vinyl Guide, the podcast for fans and collectors of vinyl records, and today we are very pleased to have on our show Mr. Charlie Musselwhite, blues music icon. Now, Charlie has been around, he's seen it all and then some, starting from his very early days in Memphis, eating cheeseburgers alongside Elvis Presley, to sharing the stage with blues legends like Muddy Waters, to even having John Lee Hooker serve as the best man at his own wedding. Oh yeah, and he's made some fantastic records too. We're going to talk to Charlie, we're going to hear his story, and you're going to want to hear it right alongside us. Plus, we're going to cover a few of Charlie's LPs you want to keep an eye out for next time you go digging through the racks of your local record shop. And it's all thanks to show sponsor, Thorne's Turntables. Cheap turntables will ruin your records. Ask your hi-fi dealer about a Thorne's turntable today. And we're also brought to you by GrooveWasher.com. GrooveWasher now has a special limited edition GrooveWasher kit made especially for Third Man Records. It's available in the Third Man retail shops in Detroit and Nashville, or online at thirdmanrecords.com. Get yours today before they sell out, or get the regular version direct from groovewasher.com. And with that, let's start today's show featuring blues music icon Charlie Musselwhite.
Do you listen to and collect vinyl records? Well, you're in luck. Welcome to The Vinyl Guide, the podcast made for record nerds like yourself. Here's your host, the biggest record nerd of them all, Nate Goyer.
All righty there, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, youngins and elderly, North Americans and South Americans, husbands and wives, cats and dogs and hedgehogs, I can go on forever. Welcome to the show, The Vinyl Guide, where we talk about vinyl records and the artists and craftspeople who make these wonderful spinning black orbs that we love so much. My name is Nate, I'm your host, and today we've got another great show. Music and blues legend Charlie Musselwhite is on the show, a man whose history is deep when it comes to the blues, living in Chicago during the 60s, sharing the stage with the likes of Muddy Waters, John Lee Hooker, Magic Sam. Oh, the list goes on. And he's here today. He's going to tell us some stories about that time. He's going to share what the blues means to him. Right now, he's age 72. He's still kicking ass, taking names, and making some great music. Check out his latest album, I Ain't Lyin', from charliemusselwhite.com, and stay tuned for this interview. I think you'll really enjoy hearing Mr. Musselwhite talk about his history with the blues. And although 2016 was a horrible year for music, with the deaths of Bowie and Prince and Fife Dog and way too many to list here. 2016 was a great year for our podcast. The Vinyl Guy community has grown 10 to 20 times what we started the year with. And it's really thanks to folks like you who've been sharing this podcast with your friends, turned other people on to what we're doing here, and really helped grow the Vinyl Guide subscriptions exponentially. So a huge thank you to everyone who shared this podcast, and another huge thanks to those of you who have left positive reviews on Apple iTunes, Stitcher, or any of the other spots. Now, it is the holiday season, and I know many of you are feeling very generous, so you need something to do with that energy, go to iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, wherever you use to listen to the show, log in and leave the Vinyl Guide a 5-star review. That's the goodness you could spread this holiday season. So do it today so I could read all the people out on next week's episode. It's our final episode for 2016, and man, it is a killer one. You're not going to want to miss this one. I'm not going to tell you who's on the show, but it's going to be great. You're going to want to listen from beginning to end. So make sure you give us a good review today and subscribe. Now, one quick thing I do want to call out, I received a flip bin from the fine folks over at flipbin.com, and man, it is a killer product for record collectors. I did a short video on our webpage. Go to thevinylguide.com. You can see the video, watch it in action. Essentially, if you have a pile of records laying flat next to your turntable, check out the flip bin. It sits them upright. It allows you to flip through them. It showcases your records like the pieces of art that they are. It's very handy. I haven't seen anything on the market quite like it. They have 12-inch and 7-inch versions, depending on what size records you collect and play the most. But overall, it is a very cool product. Check it out over at flipbin.com. Well, all right, chop chop. That's it for all the upfronts. Let's talk to blues music icon Charlie Musselwhite right after we pay some bills with our very handsome show sponsors, Thorne's Turntables and GrooveWasher.com. All right, in the past, you guys have heard me talk about Thorne's Turntables. I own a Thorne's Turntable, and it is one of the best investments I've ever made. A turntable is so central for our sound systems, especially those of us who love playing vinyl. And when it comes to turntables, you really can't get much better than Thorne's Turntables. Sure, there are cheapy ones on the market that maybe cost a couple $100, but you know those things are only built to last maybe a couple of years. They're built with cheap components and locations around the world that aren't necessarily known for their quality control. Thorne's Turntables are designed and built in Europe. This is a company that's been in business for over 100 years. They've been making turntables since Edison Phonograph. So the engineers at Thorne's really know what they're doing. They know how to get the best sound and the best bang for the buck. Now, I know sometimes when you hear about specialist turntables and things that are made in Europe, you automatically think the price is really high, but I think you'll be really pleasantly surprised. Thorne's Turntables are available in a variety of different models to suit just about any budget. They have high-end turntables, they have medium-end turntables, they have lower-end turntables for folks who are just getting into the whole vinyl game. So I would encourage you, make an investment in a good turntable, something that's going to last you years and years, something that's going to treat your vinyl well and make sure you have an audio experience that is quality and made to last. Check out Thorne's.com or ask your hi-fi dealer about a Thorne's turntable today. Thorne's, quality you can hear. All right, everybody, I'm going to spend a moment talking about our friends at GrooveWasher.com. Now, as you know, GrooveWasher is the ultimate manual record cleaning system on the market today. In my experience, nothing comes close to the GrooveWasher. Kits start at around $50, and in my mind, compete with some of the record cleaners that cost $500 or $600 or more. GrooveWasher is that good. But now, you don't just have to take my word for it. The folks over at Third Man Records agree as well. So take note of this. There is now a GrooveWasher Third Man Records limited edition record cleaning kit, complete with custom handle and colors. Now, these are limited stock and available only from Third Man retail shops in Detroit and Nashville. However, you could also reserve one online at thirdmanrecords.com. I'll put direct links on the Vinyl Guide website if you have trouble finding it. So get your limited edition Third Man Records GrooveWasher record cleaning system today before supplies are gone. Now, you can always get the regular GrooveWasher record cleaning system direct from GrooveWasher.com. It's just as effective, perhaps not quite the conversation piece of the Third Man Records version, but if your goal is clean records, either one will get you there. So go to thirdmanrecords.com or groovewasher.com to get yours today. That's groovewasher.com, and they are made in the USA. All right, so before we speak to Charlie Musselwhite, just a quick record nerd moment. In this conversation with Charlie, we talk about his record history, and it's very, very colorful, very, very lengthy. He's jumped from label to label throughout his years. And for those of you not familiar with his work, the LP that brought him notoriety is Stand Back. Here comes Charlie Musselwhite's Southside Band. Or it's simply referred to as Stand Back. Now, the Stand Back record is on the Vanguard record label, catalog number VRS9293 for mono, or VRD79293 for stereo. Now, I've got the stereo, and I've not run across the mono version yet. You can pick up the stereos for maybe $30, and the monos for around $50, but either version is great. The stereo version, from the sound of it, doesn't appear to be one of those electronically reproduced stereo issues. It seems to have true separation in the mix. Hard to say for sure, but the stereo version sounds great. Now, the mono versions of the Stand Back record have gray record labels from Vanguard, stereo versions have the brownish labels, and more recent repressings tend to have white or cream-colored labels. Now, this isn't a super collectible record, but it is a great one, and I recommend everyone with a record collection, especially if you love the blues, to seek out a copy of the Stand Back album. Now, Charlie has another few dozen records, and some of the notables from that list are Louisiana Fog from 1968 on the Cherry Red record label, The Well from 2010 on Alligator Records, his 2013 album with Ben Harper, Get Up, is on the Stax imprint. That's a great one as well. And of course, his latest, I Ain't Lying, is on Henrietta Records, and that is available from charliemusselwhite.com. Charlie is still quite active. He does play live quite a bit, and he's got some dates coming up after the new year. So go to charliemusselwhite.com, check out those dates, see if any of them are near you. There's quite a few on the West Coast I could see, but he does play around quite a bit, so keep an eye on that if he's not near you right now. But make sure you go see this man while you can. He's an absolute smasher of an entertainer. You're going to absolutely enjoy the show and his music. Hell of a guy. All right, now, without further ado, here is our Vinyl Guide conversation with blues music legend Charlie Musselwhite. So this week on the Vinyl Guide, we are honored to have with us blues legend Charlie Musselwhite, a man who's pretty much seen it all and then some. How you doing today, Mr. Musselwhite?
I'm rocking.
Excellent.
Just call me Charlie. It's fine.
You sure?
Yeah.
I feel I have to call you Mr. Musselwhite. You hold a place of honor with so many folks who listen to the Vinyl Guide and love blues music. So,
Mr. Musselwhite's my father's name.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, that's fine. If we were in the UK, I think you'd be a sir, and they would give you certain rights and give you a piece of paper to allow you to park anywhere. Charlie, you've had a heck of a life. Aside from a remarkable solo career, you've shared stages with so many legends of the blues: Howlin' Wolf, Muddy Waters, John Lee Hooker, Magic Sam, countless others. You've also recently shared the stage with the president and Michelle Obama at the White House. So it's been a heck of a ride, hasn't it?
Oh, it's almost always interesting, at least. There's a lot going on, a lot been going on, and more to happen.
Oh, well, that's great to hear. So, Charlie, before we get stuck into your legacy and all the different facets of music you've been involved in, let's talk about your early life. What was it like to be a young Charlie Musselwhite?
Well, I was born in Kosciuszko, Mississippi, and in 1944, and in 1947, we moved to Memphis, Tennessee, and that's where I grew up. And Memphis is a great town in many ways, but it's not any piece of cake to grow up in. All those river towns are kind of rough towns. But there was so much music in Memphis. There was just music all over, on the radio, on the street. You could, on a Saturday, you could just, you might hear a band off in the distance, and you just follow the sound, and you might find a band playing in somebody's yard at a barbecue or opening of some business or something. And there was, I got to know a lot of the blues guys around Memphis. First, I was, even as a little kid, I was fascinated with the street singers in Memphis, the guys on the corner with the guitar playing for tips. I was just fascinated with these guys, and I would hang around them and listen to them. And there was even a guy out by where I lived in Memphis that played along the railroad tracks where people would get off from work from the sawmill, and they'd be hanging around there drinking, and there'd be that good blues happening, and I'd be hanging out there. That'd be the only little white kid around. But so I liked all kinds of music. I liked old hillbilly music and gospel and everything, but blues sounded like how I felt, and I just felt like I had to play it, and not from a point of view of being a professional musician, but from just purely for the music. I just loved it, and it just meant a lot to me, and it still does.
You started drinking it in at a very early age with all that access. Did you grow up in a musical family?
Well, yes and no. I mean, nobody was like really professional, but like my grandmother played piano in the church and had an uncle that had a one-man band, and my mother played piano. My father played harmonica and guitar and mandolin, and almost every muscle white I've ever met played some instrument. So maybe it's genetic. I don't know.
Okay. So at least you had instruments around the house that you heard and you could pick up. Is that where you did you grab one of your father's harps? Is that how it all started?
No, he didn't encourage. Nobody encouraged me to play music. They thought that playing music was kind of low class. In their eyes, you're supposed to get a good education and get a job and settle down, you know. But I didn't see it that way. So I went, and my father did give me his guitar. He gave me an old Supertone. And I took that guitar up and down Beale Street and to all the different guys I'd gotten to know, like Will Shade and Furry Lewis and Willie B and all these different guys, and learned how to play guitar, watching them and hanging out with them, and harmonica too. I bought my own harmonicas, though. My dad didn't give me no harmonicas.
Oh, okay. So this is around when you're just becoming a bit of a teenager. You're starting to get into music with the guitar. Is that about the right time period there?
I think I was probably around 13 when I started playing harmonica and guitar. At first I was just really into the music, you know, listening to it on the radio, on the street, records. And at some point I remember thinking, what, it makes you feel so good listening. I bet it feels even better if you could play it. And, well, you got a harmonica and you got a guitar. Why don't you play them? Mm-hmm. So I remember going out in the woods with my harmonica where nobody could hear me and just making up my own blues. And I always thought that was the right approach, is to make up your own blues. So I tried to just, in the beginning, I just taught myself. And with the harmonica, you can't see what somebody's doing, so you can't really show somebody what you're doing. So you really are on your own.
Mm. Yeah, you really just have to feel it. Where do you think the blues comes from?
The heart.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, just being, living in a rough way, you need something to, a balm for your hurt, for your pain. And that's what blues is. Blues, I always say blues is your buddy in good times and your comforter in hard times. It's the all-purpose music. It's always there for you.
Mm. Oh, that's beautiful. When you play the blues, when you play your music, where are you at emotionally? What are you thinking about when you're playing some of these songs?
I can't wait to get the hell out of here. A lot of it depends on the audience. You know, if they're really enjoying it and having a good time and dancing, that feeds me to play more and entertain them more, you know. And if somebody's having a hard time, you know, sometimes people come talk to me about stuff that's happened in their life, you know, and I know they're out there listening, and I really put my heart into it for them, too.
Do you sometimes purposefully think of sad things to put yourself in the mood?
Oh, I don't have to purposely do that. It's all in there, you know. It's all the experiences I've had, they're all very alive in me.
Wow.
So my emotions do go through my music. I like to think. I don't know. I have no idea what it sounds like to other people. And I just go for what I feel and hope. I always think that somebody will like it. Maybe everybody won't like it, but somebody will.
So back in Memphis, when you were young, that's a time when I believe Elvis and Johnny Cash and the like were running around town. Ever have any run-ins with the Sun Records crew?
Oh, yeah. Well, I went to school with Tommy Cash. That was Johnny's brother. Tommy played on the basketball team, and Johnny would come to the games. And so I saw him often, and I remember seeing him driving around town. I remember seeing Jerry Lewis driving around town in a red-orange Lincoln convertible with his sleeves rolled up and smoking a cigarette. And there was a place I used to like to go to get cheeseburgers. They had great cheeseburgers. I guess Jerry Lee liked them too, because I'd see him there sometime getting a cheeseburger. And there were a lot of guys around, you know, that were just into rockabilly and blues. And I had a girlfriend of mine worked in a little theater in Memphis, and Elvis would rent that theater and show movies, the latest movies, and a whole bunch of Roadrunner cartoons, because he loved the Roadrunner. And he'd rent it from like midnight till dawn. And I'd go and I'd see him there. And I eventually somehow came up with his phone number, and I could call Elvis and find out where the party was going to be that night, you know. Sometimes he'd rent a skating rink, or sometimes he'd rent the entire Memphis Fairgrounds, and all the rides would be free, and we'd walk around. Hot dogs were free, and Cokes were free, and all the rides were free. And it was the same deal from midnight to dawn. And mostly I was going because there were a lot of pretty girls there. Even though I was going with my girlfriend, it was nice to see all these beautiful women.
Developing a backup plan.
But I didn't really. Elvis didn't know that I played anything, or he didn't hardly even know who I was. We would speak, but that was about it. I don't think I ever really had a conversation with him, but I was around him. A lot of guys in Memphis, like me, were from Mississippi, and people from Mississippi in Memphis were considered way down low on the totem pole. So in society, and when Elvis became famous, he like made us legitimate. You know, we all combed our hair and dressed like Elvis. Mm-hmm. That's the way boys from Mississippi acted. And we dressed different and acted different from people that were longtime Memphians.
So he knew you were from Mississippi. So you guys had that connection.
I don't know if he knew that, but I figure he probably figured it because of the way I dressed and combed my hair.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So you knew Elvis ran in some of the same circles. Yeah. And of course, you know, seeing Jerry Lee around town and having some connections with Johnny Cash. Ever play music with any of that crew?
Later on, I played with Billy Lee Riley, and I have some tapes around here somewhere of us playing together at a live show, but not Elvis or Jerry. No, I did play with Jerry Lee. No, let me take it back. I shared the bill with Jerry Lee Lewis. We both played at the same place one night. I don't remember playing with any of those guys other than Billy Lee Riley. And he was a really good, he really loved blues too.
So at that time in your life, were you thinking about music as a career? Were you positioning yourself to kind of go in that direction, or were you still kind of wandering a bit?
I'm still kind of wandering.
Aren't we all in some way?
Oh, it's endless. But I didn't think about it being something I was going to do to make a living as a profession. I never thought I was good enough, or you know, all the blues guys were so much older than me. I didn't see where I would fit into that situation. And when I got up to Chicago and was going to all the blues clubs, there was nobody my age in any of those clubs, and nobody white either. So I really stood out. I was really young and really white.
And what took you up to Chicago?
Oh, just looking for a job. You know, it was, everybody was getting out of the South. Well, not everybody, but there was, you know, you hear about the migration of people out of the South going north. All the factories were up in, you know, the big northern towns like Chicago, and Highway 51 and Highway 61 both went through Memphis and straight up to Chicago. And so a lot of people went straight up there from Memphis and other parts of the South. Over toward the east, like in the Carolinas, those people would go up to like Philadelphia and New York. And further west in like Arkansas and Oklahoma and Texas, those people would head out to California.
You went to Chicago looking for work. Did you find a job at a factory or anything?
Well, what happened was when I got up there, I didn't know anything about Chicago. I didn't know that there was a blues scene there at all. I had heard that anybody that was in the entertainment field either lived in New York City or Hollywood. So I had no reason to think that there was this big blues scene in Chicago, even though some of the 45s I had, all they said Chicago on them. I didn't put that together. But when I got to Chicago, I went around looking for work, and the first job I got was a driver for an exterminator. And this was perfect because I drove him all over Chicago, and I learned the city real fast, and I would see signs and posters and things about blues, about Muddy Waters and Elmore James and Howlin' Wolf. And man, I couldn't believe it. I felt like a kid in a candy store. And I'd write down the addresses, and at night I'd go back to these clubs, and man, what a thrill to walk into like Pepper's Lounge. On like a Tuesday night, I think it was 50 cents, and you got a ticket. And with that ticket, you got a free beer. And you could listen to Muddy Waters till 4 in the morning. Or if it was Saturday, till 5 in the morning. Actually, it'd be Sunday morning.
Wow.
And in the beginning, they just thought of me as a fan because I'd request tunes, and they'd say, like, how do you know that tune, boy? So, I got the record. And so they knew who I was long before they found out I played. And I wasn't going around saying, hey, can I sit in or anything like that. I was happy just to be hanging out and socializing, and coming from Memphis, I already knew how to drink. I fit right in.
And you were this young white kid in the middle of Southside Chicago. Did you feel all right? Did you feel looked after?
I felt right at home. When I first came to Chicago, I didn't know anything about North Side, South Side, West Side. I didn't know where the black neighborhood or the white neighborhood or anything. I mean, I knew zero. Mm-hmm. So I ended up living, my first little place I lived at was on the north side, which was a whole lot of hillbillies, people from Appalachia and me. And I don't know how I ended up there, but that was the first place I lived. And then, but a lot of the, when I go into like a restaurant and like the waitress would give me a big smile and say hello, as soon as she heard my accent, you'd see that smile just disappear. And I'd get called, you know, cracker and redneck and stuff like that. And, you know, they just throw the menu at you. And they could hardly even understand. Back then, my accent was so thick, they didn't even know what I was saying most of the time. I remember trying to just ask for a glass of water, and they didn't know what I was saying. What? You want what? Water. Or a glass of water. But so finally, when I moved to the South Side and lived in the black neighborhood, everybody there was either from the South or one generation removed. And they knew, they could understand me. And we all liked the same food and the same music, and I felt right at home.
Didn't need a translator or anything. That's good.
No.
So you went from being an observer, paying for your ticket, seeing Muddy Waters play all night, seeing all these folks who, you know, were well known then but are legends now. You went from observing them to eventually joining them. How did that transition happen?
Pretty easy. I'd gotten to know this waitress really well, and she told Muddy one night, "You ought to hear Charlie play harmonica," because I had played some for her. And Muddy was like, "What?" You know, he just thought of me as a fan. But when he found out I played, that changed everything. And he insisted that I sit in. And I still remember being on the stage, standing next to Muddy playing harmonica, and thinking, how the hell did I get up here? Because this wasn't part of my plan or anything. I didn't have a plan. I still don't have a plan, hardly. But anyhow, that waitress, her telling Muddy, because I wasn't going to do it. I wasn't going to ask to sit in and or tell anybody I played or promote myself in any way. When that happened, that just changed everything. Because Pepper's Lounge, a lot of musicians hung out there. If they weren't gigging, they'd be hanging out at Pepper's. And they heard me play with Muddy. From then on, anytime Muddy saw me, as long as he lived, he would always invite me to sit in. And these other musicians that saw me sitting in started offering me gigs. And boy, did that get my attention. You're going to pay me? All right. So that's how it started.
Wow. And what was, like, as soon as you started playing, do you remember Muddy's reaction or the conversation that you had shortly afterward?
I don't remember the exact conversation or anything, but I just know that I remember him smiling and laughing and talking with me and telling people about me. And, you know, a lot of the guys, you know, they considered me a homeboy. You know, I was from where they were from, you know, and so that meant something. You know, I wasn't a local Yankee.
Mm-hmm.
And
you fit right in. You're one of the crew pretty quick.
Yeah, I got to know, I was rooming with Big Joe Williams not too long after that, and he would take me all over Chicago and just playing for friends and neighbors and old buddies and drinking, and Big Walter Horton did the same thing. We would just walk all over Chicago, just walk the streets going from friend to friend of his, and he'd introduce me to them and tell them I was from down home, and we'd play together, and we'd get some drinks and just have a heck of a good time.
So how long was it from when you started getting up on the stages to when you were finally able to quit the job at the Exterminator and start doing music full time?
Well, it took a while because these clubs, the blues clubs in Chicago, were real small. So they couldn't hold a lot of people, which meant there wasn't that much money in it. Only the guys like Muddy and Howlin' Wolf and Sonny Boy and Little Walter, the guys that were making 45s, putting out records regularly and touring, they're the only guys really that could live on their music. Most of the other guys, all of them had day jobs. Or you would get a gig at a club, and they would call it a residency today, where you play in that club 4 or 5 nights a week. Week after week after week, until there'd be a shooting or something and they'd close it down, and then you'd have to go get a day job till you found another music gig. And back then, it was really easy to get jobs in factories. You could just walk in a factory and they just tell you to grab a broom until they found another job for you in the factory. So you just bounce back and forth between the music and the day job, hoping for the best. And Sam Charters would come through Chicago regularly, and he knew that I knew where everybody was playing, and he'd get me to take him around to hear people. And eventually he did that series called Chicago the Blues Today on Vanguard and had me play with Walter Horton because he had heard us play together before. And then after that, he decided to do an album with me, and that changed my life. That put me on the road and gave me a career. And I started touring after that. I started getting phone calls from all around the country, come here, come there. And so that's what happened. I've been on the road ever since 1967.
Never went back to the Exterminator after that one.
No, I just didn't feel up to it.
You called in sick. They're still waiting for you to come back. So so that was the landmark album, Stand Back. Here comes Charlie Musselwhite's Southside Band. Now, that record is one that so many fans of the blues go back to. That time on Vanguard when you were recording, how quickly was that record made?
Oh, it took 3 hours. Under 3 hours, because we were done when the 3 hours was. That's all we had was 3 hours. That was considered a session, and you got paid scale for the session. If you went 1 minute over 3 hours, you were supposed to get paid double, and they weren't going to do that, and it didn't happen.
That is a very short time to record what is, I believe, about a 40-minute record. So what do you remember about the recording sessions?
Well, I remember Fred Below on drums and Little Bob on bass and Barry Goldberg on organ and piano and Harvey Mandel on guitar. I just called them up and they met me at the studio and we just knocked them out one after another and went home.
Had you rehearsed at all? Did you know what you were going to play, or a lot of it is improvised?
A very little bit. We didn't really have time to rehearse. Everybody's pretty busy and spread out around town. But we knew the music, and we weren't concerned about that. It was real spontaneous and a lot of improvisation. And so pretty much you name the key and count it off. And away we go.
now here on the Vinyl Guide, we do get a little bit nerdy here and there. So it's all right if this information isn't readily handy in your memory. But on the Stand Back album, there are mono and stereo releases. Do you recall if the session was made with stereo in mind, or was it purely mono and then the stereo came later?
Oh, I have no idea. I know that they considered Vanguard to be real high class, or, you know, like real good vinyl and real good. They tried to get the best sound they could. So since they were basically originally a classical music company, then they kind of got off into folk, and then I squeezed in there. Mm-hmm. They thought I was playing folk music or something. But so it is conceivable that they would have recorded it with stereo. I don't know. I don't think I was interested at the time.
Well, it is very good quality vinyl. I could attest to that. I've got a copy, and 50 years later, it still sounds great to me. So,
oh, cool. It's never been out of print.
Never. No, it's just new fans.
It's always been available.
Oh, yeah. That's great. As it should. So after Stand Back, You ended up moving to the West Coast. Why the move out of Chicago to California?
Well, I kept getting these calls from all around the country, different places to leave Chicago and come play there. But I had a day job at the time, and I was married, and I had a child. And so traveling around by myself wasn't in the cards at that point. But finally, some people called up from California, and they offered me some work that was really paid well. So I thought, well, I'll just go out there. I'll take a leave of absence from the factory. I'll go out there. I'll make that money and come back. Well, I got out there. I got to California. I don't think I was there more than about 10 minutes. I knew I wasn't going back to Chicago. I mean, I realized there was lots of work all up and down the West Coast, and to the West Coast people, it seemed like they thought of blues as something exotic, and they were really hungry for it and wanted to hear it, and they wanted to pay good money for it. And so, gosh, it was a no-brainer, as they say. I had plenty of work and no reason to go back. So I called my wife and told her to pack up and come on because I wasn't coming back.
And who were the musicians? This is in San Francisco, yeah?
Right.
Who were the musicians that you started meeting there on the West Coast?
Oh, gosh, it was such a hodgepodge of everything you could imagine, all the hippies and rock guys and jazz and everything was going on at once, it seemed like. I don't know if this ever existed, but, like Bill Graham would he would turn people on to music. They would come to hear whatever he booked because they trusted his taste and his judgment. And you might be able to go to the Fillmore and hear Albert King and Ravi Shankar and some jazz group all on the same night. And it worked. It all seemed to fit together. So in that kind of a atmosphere and an environment, you end up jamming with all kinds of musicians from all kinds of backgrounds. And it was really a fertile time musically. And I just had a heck of a good time. It was fun for me to see how I could fit blues harmonica with other styles of music. And it was a good time and an interesting time.
What were some of the more interesting collaborations you think about when your mind goes back to that time?
Oh, I might be playing somewhere and maybe a jazz saxophone guy would, like somebody like Sonny Chris or John Handy would come and sit in with me, and that would push me to play better and be a better musician, and it'd be fun too, And all good jazz players know how to play blues, in my opinion.
Sure. Did you ever get into the free jazz movement? Do any of that on the harp?
When that movement first started with Pharoah Sanders and guys like that, it was really interesting, and I got a lot of ideas listening to them. It was just wild, free form music, but I could still hear where they had a blues influence and in their phrasing and tone. So, I kind of fooled around with it some.
And not too long after you were in San Francisco, you moved over to the Cherry Red record label. What were the deals with the different record labels that you worked with? Was it like one record deals or two record deals, then you moved to the next one? What was that, some of the general agreements or philosophies that you took in terms of recording for different companies?
Well, if you record for somebody, that puts your name out there because they're going to spend money on advertising and because they want to sell your record. And so it was a way to keep your name, known, and you get played on the air and stuff like that. But sometimes with a small label, it might just be a flat fee, and you just do it, and that's it. And other labels, they want to sign you up and keep you just for them for like 3 to 5 years or something like that. So there's different deals. Whatever deal you could make, the best deal you could make was what you could get, it wasn't any one formula of how to do things. And coming from Chicago like that, and where I had been playing just in those little clubs, it was like I got thrown in the deep end of the pool. Because I didn't know nothing about the music business. And so I just had to make a lot of mistakes, trial and error, step by step. And I got burned a lot. And, well, everybody did. Mm-hmm. That's like the nature of the business. Don't mean I like it any better, but that's the way it worked.
Now, so you mentioned a little bit ago that the Stand Back album has never been out of print. Do you continue to see royalties or payments from any of your back catalog that goes that far back?
Very little. I signed a really bad deal. And even after Vanguard was sold to Kevin Welk, who is Lawrence Welk's son, he refused to renegotiate the contract. And then now Concord owns Vanguard, and they're not going to renegotiate either. So I get just pennies, hardly nothing.
But at least it's consistent pennies.
Well, here's a story for you. After I recorded Stand Back, I was really looking forward to getting my session check. It was supposed to be several hundred dollars. I don't remember how many, $300 or $400. And I'm waiting and waiting, and finally the union calls me and says, "We got a check from Vanguard here for you. Come on down." And so I went downtown and went to the union, and they said, "Okay, you got to pay us $4 for work dues for before we give you the check." I said, "Well, how much is that check for?" And it was, they showed me the check. It was for 36 cents. Vanguard deducted everything they could think of from my session fee. And that, and I didn't have the $4. So I never even got the check for 36 cents.
Yeah, that tale has been told far too many times. So yeah. With musicians all over the world. So really, Stand Back, it put you on the map, but it didn't put too much money in your pocket. You had to go out and then earn that.
Yeah, but it did give me a career, and that's, mm-hmm. that's to be considered.
So after the Stand Back album, you went to a few different record labels. One of the records you had, Louisiana Fog, has a credit on it for Daryl Dragon playing piano on several tracks. You remember mm-hmm. your interaction with Daryl there?
Yeah, I remember him. He was real quiet, didn't talk much. But I thought he was a good player, and he was a nice guy. I didn't know him real well, but I thought he added to the session. I forget how I met him or how he came to be there. I must have known somebody that knew him, and they invited him over, something like that.
I guess a lot of the musicianship kind of came together that way. Someone knew someone else and they brought him over, and it just that's how the recording session came together. It sounds like you recorded with quite a few people that you may not have even known very well.
Oh yeah, that happens all the time. Mm-hmm. But usually you're at least acquainted on some level. I mean, you might know their music and not know them personally. And you just cross paths with people in all kinds of situations and try to keep track, and things just keep happening.
So for the Vinyl Guide listeners who may not know, Daryl Dragon became the captain in Captain and Tennille not long after this album he made with Charlie, Louisiana Fog. Charlie, by chance, was he wearing the captain's hat at the time?
You know, I think he did wear a hat like that then. I think that's where the nickname came from. He didn't get the nickname and then start wearing the hat.
Oh, okay. Well, good old Daryl Dragon. One day he'll be promoted to admiral. So Charlie, when you think back to your early solo work, what's aside from Stand Back, which obviously you have, there's a keen fondness for, it puts you on the map and good memories around that. What is the LP or a couple of LPs that you look back on with the most pride?
Gosh, there's so many now. Some of the later ones on the Henrietta label, I especially am fond of because it's on our own label, and it belongs to us 100%. And every one of those records I sell, all that goes right in my pocket instead of getting split up a bunch of ways and just getting pennies. So, and I like the music, and I think we did a good job with it. But all in all, you have to put Stand Back at the top because it really gave me a career. That's the one that did it.
That is a great album. And let me just quickly say for the listeners, if you want to hear some of the music Charlie's talking about on the Henrietta record label, go to charliemusselwhite.com. There's several albums there. The new CD is called I Ain't Lying. And and I ain't lying when I say it is great.
Thank you.
It is an excellent maturity. It sounds like you're in a really good place in your life right now.
Yes, I think it's well put. Mm. And I admire your taste.
Well, I had good instructors along the way.
No doubt.
So in terms of some of the personal relationships you've had, you had a very close friendship with John Lee Hooker. Can you talk to us a little bit about how that came to be and the relationship that you guys had over the years?
Well, John lived in Detroit when I was living in Chicago, but he came to Chicago regularly to play, and I would go see him. And the first time I went to see him was at a club owned by Big Bill Hill. I forget the name of it. It was on Roosevelt Road. Anyhow, as soon as we met, it was like we just were instant friends. It was like we were old friends, like we already knew each other. Mm-hmm. And from then on, we were real close friends. And when I went out to California, I called John. I said, John, I think you're going to really love California. You better come on out. You're going to love the girls. And I don't know if that's why he moved, but it wasn't long after that that he came out to Oakland, California. Mm-hmm. I remember going to visit him right when he just first came. And then later on, when I got married to Henrietta, he was my best man. And we were close friends all through life. And I recorded with him many, many times.
Those are some great tracks. When you talk to John about his history and the music that he made, were there any particular albums or tracks that of his that he was particularly proud of?
Oh, I'm sure he was. I think he was pretty much proud of everything he did. And I mean, he took a lot of pride in his work. And I don't remember him talking specifically about any one particular recording. I personally really loved his early stuff where he just played solo guitar by himself with his foot tapping, you know, like Hobo Blues and mm-hmm. Crawling King Snake and all those early tunes like that, Burning Hell. Man, that was some powerful music to me. Still is.
What was his work ethic like? Did he play hours each day? Did he play occasionally? Like what did you witness in terms of his frequency of playing and practicing?
Well, I know when he first started crossing over, it was kind of with the folk crowd. He'd recorded for Riverside, and he was playing folk clubs like the Second Fret in Philadelphia, and I don't remember the names of all those clubs now, but it was quite a folk scene at that time, and he was smart enough to really take advantage of it. I didn't see him perform in those clubs, but people I knew that did see him say he played long sets, you know, just by himself, sitting there playing one tune after another. Later on, when he was up in years and had his band, he would just, you know, play like one set. He'd let the band play for, I don't know, three or four tunes and on their own, then he'd come out. And of course, he was getting up in years then. He was not like a spring chicken anymore. Mm-hmm. Neither am I. But he really was proud of his music and his career. And yeah, he was very proud of it, a proud man. And as well he should be.
And one of the lesser discussed but still very important blues musicians is Magic Sam. And you had time with Magic Sam on stage and off. Can you talk a little bit about that relationship?
Yeah, Sam was great. He was just a great, great guy. Still miss him. If he had lived, he would just I think he would be a huge star today. He had that charisma. And he was a great guitar player and great singer, and people just loved him everywhere he went and anybody that heard him. We toured together a few times, and he and I recorded backing up Shaky Jake on a couple of tunes one time in the middle of a riot, I remember. But we were good friends, and I just thought the world of Sam, and I still miss him. I wish he would have lived.
Oh, yeah. Those two records that he recorded on Delmark are just phenomenal. And they're still putting out his B-sides and whatnot. And it sounds like you two played together on a song for Shaky Jake. Do you remember the name of that song?
Well, we did two tunes.
Okay.
I remember when Jake called me up and wanted me to come over there and record in his basement. He had a little reel-to-reel recorder. And I said, Jake, there's a riot going on. I don't know. And he said, man, get on the bus and get over here. You know, ain't nobody going to mess with you. And I got on the bus and went over there. Nobody paid me any attention. Nobody even looked at me twice, you know. And I got over there, and Sam was there, and we recorded. Lester Dorsey was on drums. I remember that. Lester, Sam, and me, and Jake. It was just us in Jake's basement and his little reel-to-reel recorder. And we cut two tunes. I don't remember the titles, but I'm pretty sure Alligator included at least one of them on one of my albums. Maybe I've got it mixed up with something else, but I think somebody reissued at least one of those tunes.
I'm going to have to do a little digging for that. Oh, I'd love to hear it. That was one of my questions was, did you ever record with Magic Sam? I'm delighted to hear that there is a couple of recordings out there.
Well, Jake wanted to put this on a 45, and it was just a test pressing. And I think I still have that test pressing somewhere around here. And that's where whoever borrowed that from me, I hope they gave it back. They used that test pressing to put out those two tunes, or at least one of them.
Oh, so that was the only copy of the tunes, the two-track. Who knows where that's at, but the test pressing was the only linkage that we have to those songs these days.
As far as I know, yeah.
Wow, okay. Do you got a big record collection at home there, Charlie?
I've got thousands of 78s, 45s, albums, 10-inch albums, CDs.
Yeah.
Only thing I don't have is any, I don't have those old rolls that they used to make. Cylinders.
Wax cylinders, no? Okay.
Yeah.
So how many hours a day do you spend listening to music?
Oh, it just depends on the situation. I might not listen to anything on some days. And other days I might spend the whole day looking through all my records trying to find something or something I remembered or something I want to be inspired by or to learn something from or just to listen. I listened to a lot of YouTube stuff. It's fun to kind of scroll through you can find on YouTube. Sometimes you find some things you've never heard of before that are real cool. Then you go find the record.
Do you have an iPhone or anything like that?
I have a smartphone. It's not an iPhone. It's a Samsung Note 3.
Uh-oh. That's not the one that catches on fire, is it?
That's a 7. I hear you can get those real cheap now.
Yeah. Yeah. When you think about your record collection, what are the records that bring you the most happiness?
Oh, gosh. well, just off the top of my head, I remember when I had a 78 player. I still have it, but it's down in Mississippi right now. It was my mom's. It was a floor model radio 78 player. And when you play a 78 on that thing, wow, it sounds so much richer and fuller than on a any modern player, it seems like. And I still remember the thrill of finding some blue 78s in a junk store and getting home and putting that on the player. And when this needle touched the grooves and that sound came out, whoa, it felt good.
That magic just rushes back after all these years. So you have the same record player and the same records from your youth?
Well, I have some new record players too, but I have the old floor model 78 player that belonged to my mom in a house in Clarksdale, Mississippi. And I'm planning on, when I finish my place there that I'm working on, I'll get it out and plug it in and I'll use it. And I'm looking forward to that.
So you still have the same 78s you had as a boy? Did those made it through the moves? And
I've got most of them. I mean, some of them got broken, and I remember I had a copy of Paddling Madeline and Rainy Night Blues or something by Get Fiddle Jim. And I was new in Chicago at that time, and I showed it to Bob Kester and a Jazz Record Mart and Del Mar Records, and he offered to trade me a vinyl album for that 78. So I didn't know nothing about, you know, record collecting or the value of records or nothing. All I knew was, well, the 78 had two tunes on it, and the album had 12 tunes on it. So I was the winner in this situation. And after the deal was made, Bob told me that was the first that anybody had actually seen and heard this record. They knew it existed, but nobody had ever seen it. And he's turned around and sold it for, I think, $700 or something, which was a huge amount of money in the early 60s.
It's a huge amount of money now.
So he screwed me, and he knew it. But I was naive and didn't know what I was doing.
Mm. And at least you got those 10 extra songs. That's good.
Yeah.
Now, in 2013, you had the honor of playing at the White House for the president and Michelle Obama, alongside other soul and music legends. How did that performance come about?
Well, it was a tribute to Memphis. The White House has a regular music program that I don't know what all they do, but this one program that they wanted to do was a tribute to Memphis. I don't know who actually came up with the idea and put it together, but I remember afterwards a lot of right-wing Republican people saying, that Obama spending all that money for those artists and paying them all that. And I said, listen, pal, nobody got paid a penny. And the White House, Obama didn't pay any of your tax money for any of that. It was the local promoters. It was PBS and I think another promoter combined that took care of all the expenses. And nobody was paid anything. Even Justin Timberlake was there. He didn't get paid anything. We did it because it was Obama's White House, and we're fans of his. And that's why we were there. And we were glad to all be together and performing this music that we love. And it was a really wonderful experience and a good time, and I really enjoyed it.
Did you get any time, any one-on-one time with the president?
I had already met him at a friend's house in San Francisco, and I gave him a harmonica. And I said, I hear you like blues, and if you ever want some lessons, I'd be glad to show you how to play some blues harmonica. And he said, well, that's really great, Charlie, but I'm kind of busy right now.
Yeah. Well, he'll have some time come February, so maybe the phone will start ringing then.
Could be.
All right. Well, Charlie, it's been great talking with you. Let me just ask, you know, what's next for Charlie Musselwhite?
Well, I'm doing a couple of movies, and I'm working on several recordings that are in the can. Someone is in the can and two to be done, and the one that's in the can is me playing mostly guitar. Hmm. While playing guitar on every tune, and I overdubbed the harmonica. And it's just a kind of a solo record with a local. I recorded it in Clarksville, Mississippi, and I used a local drummer named Quicksand. So that'll be fun, and it'll be on my. I don't know if it'll be on my label or not. I don't know what I'm going to do with it yet, but I'm going to be putting that out pretty soon.
And you're making some movies. You're going Hollywood on us, eh, Charlie?
Well, I wouldn't quite say Hollywood. These are pretty low budget.
Okay, Bollywood.
I just finished doing a biker movie called Rebel on the Highway.
Mm-hmm.
And that's going to be a lot of fun for people.
Oh. And are you playing a biker?
Well, no, I play Gabriel from the Bible, except I play a harmonica instead of a trumpet. And the guy that plays God is a biker. And it's all about bikers and I don't want to give it away, but it's a good story and a lot of fun.
Oh, we're looking forward to that. One last question for you, Charlie. If with the modern music that you hear these days and the different artists that are available, who would you most like to be a sideman for these days?
Whoa. that's a good one. Well, in the past, I really enjoyed doing that with Cyndi Lauper and Ben Harper. And Ben and I are going to do, and his band are going to do another album in January. So I'm really looking forward to that. As far as, well, if I could go back in time.
Sure.
Charlie Patton. That's where I want to go. That's where I want to be. In his prime.
So I can imagine that that's what heaven's like for you. There's a spot right next to Charlie Patton, with a harp sitting there waiting for you.
Yeah, I like to go back to sometime in the 30s there or the late 20s. I don't know, on a Saturday night, and if it was on the Dockery Plantation, Pop Staples would probably be there too because he learned guitar from Charlie Patton, and we could have a heck of a jam session.
Charlie, thank you so much for spending time with us. And again, I want to share with the audience to check out charliemusclewhite.com. It's got all those new records that you could order. The CD I Ain't Lying is a great one. Make sure you pick that up. It's not available on vinyl at this point. Maybe one day it will. But right now you can grab it on CD. And let me tell you, it doesn't lose any energy in that form. And you can also check out Charlie's live dates on the same website. Go to charliemusclewhite.com, check him out. If he's coming near your town, even if he's not near your town, make the effort to go see him because this guy is definitely a legend and you'll have a great time. Charlie, I hope you guys make it down to Australia at some point. I know you don't drink, but there's nothing stopping you from buying me a beer.
Absolutely. I'd love to.
Well, I'd love to drink it.
We
all
love
right.
Australia.
Oh, excellent. Well, we hope to see you down here at some point. Thank you very much, Charlie. Much appreciated.
Thank you.
Ah, that there is a nice guy. I mean, not only is Charlie Musclewhite a gentleman, but he's also very generous with his time and his advice to musicians and music fans. He's very, very switched on, isn't he? I mean, lots of humor and still going great. So God bless you, Charlie. Now, everyone, make sure you check out Charlie Musclewhite's new CD, I Ain't Lying, from charliemusclewhite.com. Also, while you're on the website, check out his tour dates. If he's anywhere near you, book some tickets. You're going to have a hell of a night. I guarantee it. See this man while you can. CharlieMusclewhite.com. So that's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Make sure to tune in next week. It is the last episode for 2016. 2016's been a crap year for music and musicians' deaths. But look, it's been a great year for The Vinyl Guide. We've been picking up steam, and we are definitely ending 2016 on a high. Make sure you tune in. I'm counting on all of you guys to be listening along with your friends. Make sure you get them to subscribe as well. Turn them on to it. Post it on your Facebook page. Post it on one of your fan pages that you're a part of. If you like NoFX, or if you like John Lee Hooker, you like whoever you like, make sure you put some links out there of The Vinyl Guide and turn people on to it. All right, so for The Vinyl Guide, this is Nate. I'm going to see you all next week. Hope you're all doing well. Until we talk next time, keep spinning. Cheers.
That's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Send your thoughts to Nate at thevinylguide.com or follow or tag us on Instagram at Vinyl Guide. Until next time, keep spinning.